You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates. You're listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join Coach C, the USA Strength and Conditioning Hall of Famer, every Monday night to see in a variety of guests, including former players, former and current coaches, pastors, and others will discuss relevant issues in coaching today's athlete, with the goal of equipping the athlete and those coaching them with the physical, mental, and spiritual armor necessary to live their best life. Here's Coach Connors.
Welcome to Absolute Empowerment for our sixth show. Tonight we have with us the most decorated strength and conditioning coach in the history of the NFL, Al Miller. And I'm going to make an attempt to go through his background before we get started here, Al. But great to have you with us.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate you having me.
Al played at Louisiana Monroe, previously known actually, he played at Northeast Louisiana, now known as Louisiana Monroe. All-conference twice as a receiver. Masters from Louisiana Tech in 1974. Had quite a bit of collegiate experience before moving to Alabama under Bear Bryant. Joined Dan Reeves with the Broncos in 1985 and was with him for 19 years with the Broncos, the Giants, and the Falcons. They had multiple divisional championships and four Super Bowl appearances. Al coached in two Pro Bowls, retired in 2006, and then returned in 2012 for a couple years there with a total of 24 years in the NFL. Some of his accolades, 1981 Northeast Louisiana Golden Anniversary football team member, 1982 Northeast Louisiana University Hall of Fame, 1993 the President's Award, which was a special award for strength and conditioning in the NFL, 1998 the Emmerich, Ricky, and Jones Award, which was also a special strength and conditioning award for NFL coaches, 2004 NFL Strength and Conditioning Coach of the Year, 2005 USA Strength and Conditioning Coaches Hall of Fame inductee, and then in 2007 also with the SCA was honored as a legend in the field with Al Vermeil, Meg Stone, and Boyd Epley. And I know that was a special one for you, Al, because your friendship with Al Vermeil.
Yes, it really was. That, you know, I guess all of them are something I never expected. And everybody says that, but I truly mean it. I mean, they never entered my mind. But when you get down, somebody says that you're a legend in something. Me? That's got to be a stretch.
Well, I've been in it for a while. I don't know anybody in strength and condition doesn't know who you are, Al. So,
well, I appreciate
congratulations on all your accomplishments. And, you know, we're not going to talk a whole lot about nuts and bolts of strength and conditioning. I know you've done podcasts in the past. Basically, we're focusing on that totally. But this particular podcast has a little bit of a different flavor to it, a little bit of a different objective to it. And we hope we get more than just strength and conditioning coaches listening to the podcast, of course. Wanted to talk a little bit about how I met you. I just called you out of nowhere somewhere in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just a young strength coach trying to learn from the best. Somebody told me you were the best, so I just called you out of the blue and asked you if I could come out there for about, you know, 3 or 4 days, week, whatever. And it was a great trip for me in a lot of ways. I'd never been out to Denver, of course, and so it was nice to kind of drive around and look at the scenery. And I drove up to some park way up in a mountain somewhere. I said, well, someday I got to bring my wife here. But it was a great week. Really enjoyed watching you work. And, you know, I just tried to basically absorb everything that you talked about, and you did share the information to me that is in your book, The System, of course, to an extent, you know, it made me promise not to basically share that with anything, or the KGB would be hunting me down.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, that secret Russian periodization scheme, undulating periodization scheme, I did, you know, I eventually shared it with my assistant, Jay Butler. And then later on, Jay became friends with Johnny Parker, who, of course, you and he wrote the book, and basically that helped him in his career as well. But, you know, we'll come back to that and some of the nuts and bolts. But, you know, the thing that I recognized also, Al, was I recognize you as a man of great character and integrity, who was adamant about a standard and doing things right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that really hit home with me because I grew up in Western PA where football was very intense and same type of thing. And really, it was just right along everything that I believed. And that kind of encouraged me in the profession that I could demand accountability, work ethic, discipline, right, spirit. You know, from the people that I was going to train, and right, I felt that those intangibles were more important than the nuts and bolts, to be honest with you, because if you don't have those in a program or anything you do in life, you're right, not going to be successful.
Right.
You got to have great character traits. And so I was excited after coming and meeting with you, and I was energized to do my job better. So I'll always be thankful for that visit. And, you know, getting back to what people haven't really talked to you a whole lot about, probably is, I know that you grew up without a father, and, but you were highly accomplished as a young man. And, you know, to me, you had to be somewhat faith driven to be successful in that respect. So can you tell us something about your family and the coaches who influenced you and your faith and those things that contributed to the man you became?
I'd be more than happy to, Jeff. And, you know, because I'll be honest with you, and I've had a lot of time, you know, after my career has been over with, to sit back and think about what has happened to me, you know, from when I started out, and just say like that little 12-year-old boy that started lifting weights that one day. And, you know, and I was thinking about how did all of this happen? You know, why me? And, the thing that I look back at is strictly one thing. It's not me. And if it was one person, it's our Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that he puts people into people's lives. I think you could probably say, and I'll just take a wild guess at it, that you can name probably two or three people right now that were strictly, strongly influential in your life, that without them, if they weren't there, where would you be? So anybody that's risen up like you have, that's at the levels of like we have climbed to, it's by one thing, and it's not necessarily, you know, the person. You've got to be able to be there and do things correctly and all of that, and that comes from other people that teach you what to do. So I think that being said, then yes, I had a father that was was the sole money winner of our family and passed away. Mom didn't have a job and we had to make it. And my sister, older sister, she was 5 years older than I was, still is. And, you know, it times are hard. They really were. And I don't want to be boisterous with that, but that was true. It was time. Mom didn't have a job, and Daddy sure didn't have a wealth of money. So we had some tough times there. But the one thing that always happened at the Miller house on Sunday was Al Miller and Rachel Miller were always in that Presbyterian church, Sunday school and church, every Sunday. Now, there are a lot of times if I told you that I ended up and knew everything about the Bible, this, that, and the other, I'd be lying to you. I didn't use the time wisely, but I had a calling one time when I was, Daddy had been dead. I was still in junior high, and the preacher got up there that one day, and he started talking about, being saved, giving your life to Jesus Christ and, being baptized and so forth and so on along those same lines. And, I was sitting there beside my mom just like I did every Sunday, and something hit me. I think you and I both maybe know what it is, but I got up and I started down the aisle, and before my mama could grab back of my neck and pull me back down, I walked down that aisle down to the pulpit down there and was baptized. That was the start of it, I think. There was a lot of times in between that time and the next time that I had a real encounter was probably 10, 15 years ago. And, I strayed, be honest with you, from my upbringings right there. But it did occur. And then the other thing, Jeff, is that I had strong people in my life. I am so fortunate. I had to make it in football. I mean, it was either I was going to make it and go to college. We didn't have enough money for me to go to college, just pure and simple. If I didn't get a scholarship, then I wasn't going to go to college. So I was going to work in the oil fields. And I'd already been in those oil fields, and that's a tough way to make a dollar. And it's a long climb to the top on that right there, and that's hard. I loved sports, and I loved it. When the man, Mr. Miller, came in and introduced me to weight training, and he did that, that opened up my whole nother deal to my life. His name was Ralph Miller. There was no relationship. And he showed me how to lift weights. And he took, I've told this story before, he took my arm out there, and, we were... I was about 12 years old, maybe 13. He said, I want you to make a muscle. Boy, I threw that thing up there just proud of that little bean poking out there, And yeah, I think he measured it something like 10 and a half inches. And I just thought that was it, And he said, we did a set of curls and then set it down, talked a while, did another set of curls. He said, let's try another one. And we did another set of curls. And then I said, a little tough, So and then he said, well, let's just finish up and do one last set. So I got down to about 7 and it just played. So we helped it. My other arm helped it on. Well, I shook that arm a little bit. And so he took that tape measure out, and that thing measured out about a quarter of an inch more than what it already had. And I'll never forget it, Jeff. It just blew up just like a bomb in front of my eyes. I looked up the sky and I said, my Lord, in a month, I'll be a monster. I said, why doesn't anybody know about this thing? And I started showing some of my friends in, and it worked on them too. And so there you go. That's how it all got started. But with my spiritual life, kind of went hand in hand with my sports. I was with good men that taught me toughness. They taught me work ethic. They taught me manners. That's another thing that was taught in my household. And they taught me also about the Lord. There was, we had a great head coach in Garland Gregory, and he was a wonderful human being. We had another one named Dwight Adams and Tommy Brasher. All those, I think that if you could Google them, I think that you'll find that all of those are exceptional, not only players, but also exceptional coaches.
Yeah.
And then I went to college. I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship. And then I parlayed that into finding a girl down there that would have me and married me. And she was the prettiest thing I've ever seen. We had a wonderful life together. And then, as I mentioned to you, I think it was in, we were in Atlanta and we noticed something was wrong with her.
Yeah.
And we took her down. Finally, it got to where that it she and Wade Phillips's wife, Lori, were very good friends. And we talked. And a couple of things happened that we took her down and got evaluated. And they told us that time she did have Alzheimer's, and she had also visual agnosia, which basically renders a person blind. Mm-hmm. So she had both of those. And the guy said that one thing is that she had the fast acting kind, which means that her lifespan would be short rather than carried on. So I figured out how much time I needed to be able to get in to retire. And I did so because I knew if all the things, and we had two wonderful children, Brian was my oldest son and Lisa, who's there now still in Atlanta. She was our daughter, obviously. And we raised them and we always talked just like couples do about, the golden years, of when we got, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. I was going to hold my end up to that bargain. And they say for better, for worse, that's what it is. And so I took it upon myself to take care of her there. And I did the best I could. And we had a lot of good fun. Moved back over here to Louisiana to where she knew a lot of people. And we knew a lot of people that could help. And we did. We had a lot of fun. In that period of time, my faith was really tested. I'll never forget, if you've ever talked to someone that's dealt with taking care of an Alzheimer's patient or someone of that consequence, it's 24/7. And I tell you what, so you get worn down and things start to taking place. And so the one thing everybody does is what do they say? First knee jerk reaction to anything. Why me, Lord? Poor little old me.
Yeah.
Poor little old me. Yeah. Why me? So I said that one time out on the back porch, after something. And I said that and I thought, wow, that's not right. That's not right. And I basically sat there and apologized. And I said, I'll never say that again, because things were provided for us, done for, you know, we had a wonderful life together. And so I wasn't, and there are a lot of other people besides me that had to go through it. So I'm going to stand up, try to do what is right by her. And that is going to be the best. And that was what I always did that. During that period of time, that's when I was fighting. I was fighting. You know, Johnny Parker called me, or I probably called Johnny at that period of time. And Johnny was still working. And I don't know that how many people do know this, but Johnny was the son of a preacher and a very, very spiritual person, and knows each, and had been a dear friend of mine for a long time. And we were there one time, boy, and I called him and I told him, I said, Johnny, I said, man, it's getting hard. It's just tough. I just don't know if I, you know, I'm just basically about at my wit's end. And he told me this. He said, Al, sometimes you've got to walk that lonesome valley. You got to walk it all by yourself. Yeah. Nobody else can do it for you, you know. And right. I tell you what, that was one of the things. Johnny had no way of knowing that, but there was one of the things that we always said at our First Presbyterian Church here in El Dorado. It was one of our prayers all the time, and it is a lot of the times here in the Presbyterian Church I belong to in Monroe. And with that being said, I thought again, it brought me back. It yanked the knot in me that I needed. And he's right.
Yeah.
You know, he's right. I mean, he's right. Johnny was right on the money. And for that instance right there, that's when I started trying to be able to understand what I was in, and understand what the best thing needed to be done for her and to keep my sanity and religion. And after that, fast forward, my wife passed away. And when she did, after that, then I remarried. And I remarried a woman that told me that, you know, it was going to be a Christian home that she moved into. And I said, that's fine with me. And our preacher at that time was a kid that I coached in junior high and a good football player. And he still is. He was the preacher. And now he was the assistant preacher. But we made it. And I really reaffirmed my religion at that time. Yeah. And that's my... that's my plan. And I'll tell you this, and I've told people this too, and this is all, yeah, the people have to get up in the morning, get to work, do as good as they can do every day and all that stuff. But I mean, there was one time that I was in Waco, Texas, and I got out of coaching, worst move ever made in my life, for about a year. And I went to work for a, let's just say, non-reputable individual. And I knew I'd made the wrong mistake. And or I'd made a mistake. And I was driving to work one day. And I never did this before or after. And I just pulled off the side of the road. And I just prayed to the good Lord above. I said, hey, I know that this is not for me. I need to get back into coaching. And I said, if you ever can see it in your way to be able to put me there. I'll never ask to leave or never will leave on my again. And not too long after that, that was when I got the job with Mississippi State that Bubba, we were talking about. Yeah.
Right.
And there you go. So for me to tell you that, oh boy, this is about Al Miller and Al Miller this and Al Miller that. It's not. And there's a higher person. And I think people need to realize that. Coaches need to realize that. Everybody needs to realize that. Because if you're going to make it in here, and there's a lot of them that don't, then if that's the direction you're going, you need to make sure of where you're going to go. And when you get caught, and you're going to get caught in that old valley of the shadow of the death, I promise you that. Everybody is. You can't get out of here alive without it. And what you going to do?
Right.
What you going to do? How you going to react, you know? So it's I've been through it. And I promise you this. I don't wish that on anybody. And but that's it. Jeff, pretty much right there. That's the spiritual end of me and my wife and I. And I have tried to be a better father to my children, Christian-wise, than I was when they were growing up. They're great kids now. They're great kids. But, you know, they have children of their own. And I keep telling them, you know, I feel like that I have. And that's one of my prayers I make all the time is to help my children, you know, because of me. And it's past me. I didn't do it at that time. And if you didn't do it and you try to make amends for it, I mean, that's tough sledding right there. Tough sledding. So it's better to get it done on the way through and not have to do like I did.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that story. And I know a lot of people will. And it's kind of funny that Johnny Parker always has something deep filled with wisdom to say to us. Pretty much every time I've been around him. And but I'm really glad to hear that you're strong now and moving forward.
Yep.
And I know that was a tough time, and I experienced that a little bit with the grandfather. I know maybe a little bit about it, but you know, glad to hear and glad to see that you continue to move forward and staying strong.
Trying my best. Trying day to day, Jeff.
What I wanted to ask you about, when you were with Bear Bryant, did you somewhat see him, you know, as a father type figure in some regard? I know you had tons of respect for him because I've taught you a little bit about it, you know, of course, when I visited. But what was the Bear Bryant culture like?
Well, I think that any person that's ever coached for him, worked for him, played for him, or anything like that, he was a father figure to us all. I mean, really was. I mean, he had a persona that, you know, it was that was just, what's the word I'm looking for? Is that not, you just didn't find with anybody, you know. I had a general in the Army when I was in Fort Knox. It was General Patton's son. Mm-hmm. And he was one-star general, and he had a commanding atmosphere around him, a lot like Coach Bryant. Mm-hmm. And but that Coach Bryant was different. You know, he was raised, or I was raised, however, we were born and raised 40 miles from each other. And But so, you know, it was something I learned a lot. I had great coaching, as I said. And because I had that great upbringing, good, great coaching, great high school coaching, and great coaches to teach me along the way, then, you know, they reinforced the things that he said. So I, you know, a lot of the stuff that that he was preaching and doing were already done with me, you know, and I'd heard that and I believed. I mean, man, look, I was 100% in for it. And but he, yeah, he was different. He's different. And I, and how is he different? I mean, just different. I mean, he had a way about him that demanded respect.
Right.
And that's it. Yeah. But yet and again, he was just like me, and just like he said, he was just a simple old country boy, you know. And
yeah. That's,
he was raised in Fort Dyce. I was raised in El Dorado. I mean, there ain't a cut dog's difference between the two of us, you know.
Yeah. I got you. Well, that was also during the time, and I went through it myself, the 3-a-days, 2 weeks of 3-a-days when I was in college playing, and you really didn't question a coach much at all. I mean, or you wouldn't be there very long, and it was a little different then.
Times are always changing.
Yeah, that's right.
The only thing God told me long, long, long time ago, and he said, boy, the only thing that stays the same in this world is change. And he was right. And
no doubt.
I agree. And
it's definitely something you can count on for sure.
That's it. You know, football changing, everything, and it does. And so consequently, when you say, you know, boy, this or that, change is going to occur. And the thing you've got to do, though, is know what where your loyalties lie, know where your strength is, and stick with those, irregardless of what happens in the outside world.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talked about the guy that influenced you. I was just going to tell you a little story. When I was about in 10th grade, there was a guy that I met that was coming around. He was from my hometown, kind of a bunch of little coal mining towns. And his name was Tom Doman. And he played both ways for West Virginia, center and linebacker for Pappy Lewis. And he played with Chuck Halley and all those boys.
Yeah.
Back in the day, and he said, I got something special for you. There's a chiropractor I'm friends with, and he got this new line of equipment I'm going to take you and take you through today. I'm like, oh, you know, because I was just learning about strength training, and he took me in there where they had this stuff called Nautilus. And he put me on that first machine, and I don't even remember what it was. I was maybe hitting back, I don't know, and then I went to the double chest and, of course, the leg press, and about the 56. Yeah. I said, man, I'm starting to get, why am I feeling sick? And because there was no rest provided.
Yeah.
And you were going to failure on every set, along with some force reps at the top end. And, you know, here, long story short, I ended up having a Nautilus Fitness Center myself at some point when I was in TMI Academy in Tennessee. And then I had a powerlifting team at the same time. We used Nautilus kind of as a supplementary deal, but, you know, when we were training the public, of course, it was you get with your trainer, you got one shot on this machine, you got one set, we're going to take you through these 14, 15 exercises, kick you out the door. And, you know, it's kind of really interesting then, because it gained popularity among some programs that had the money to buy the equipment.
Right.
But if you look around now, you can't find a Nautilus machine anywhere, and all you're going to see pretty much is racks and platforms.
Well, you know, in that period of time that you were talking about, when it came about, Arthur Jones created Nautilus machines, and I'd started coaching in junior high, and then I went to high school. And I started in high school. Then I went, my head coach went on and became the head coach in college. And I went to college. And when I did, we were going to rebuild a lot of our field house and everything, which did need reconstruction. And so what we wanted to do is that he brought me in, and we were training with weights. Now, I mean, we trained with weights in junior high, and we did the things. And, you know, the one thing that I don't think this name is mentioned enough to, Jeff, is Alvin Roy. Yeah. And I think he's the reason that we all have a job. He really is. And he was from right down here in Baton Rouge. And, you know, that's another story within itself. But, you know, with that being said, we never trained with free weights.
Yeah.
The Nautilus, just like you said, came into being, and boy, I mean, bingo. I mean, you know, at the hoopla and everything. So, we had at that time, I thought it was a large sum of money, and it was. We called down and started reaching out and talking to people, you know, hey, Jeff Connors, I heard you have Nautilus equipment. Yeah, sure. And then obviously you wanting to sell it and I'm wanting to buy it. So make a partnership. So I went down to a little town down in Florida.
DeLand,
Florida. That's right. And he had a guy down there named Casey Viator. Casey was Mr. America down there.
Yeah.
Remember that? And
And
he and I worked out together. And I went through that same deal with him. But before then, that I had heard about it a little bit. And I tried to get in good shape as I could. I was still in my 20s at that time. So,
yeah.
But that we bought some of that equipment, and it will work. But there are other things, you know, now you got to worry about time. You got to worry about this, that, and the other, but, I still think if the free weights, if you know how to be able to use them, are the way to go. Now for athletes, guys like me that way past prime at machines. Yeah.
Well, of course, back then you could go to a conference and you guys stand up there and argue back and forth about the, you know, you had Ken Manny and you had Dan Riley, of course. Riley was big with it with Penn State and with Washington Redskins, whatever. And, you know, I went through that whole phase with everybody. And, you know, I went up there and interviewed with Joe Paterno, like it was 1993, I think. And you know, when I showed him a film of what I was going to bring in there, and he said, "What would you do with the weight room?" I said, "Well, I'd clear all this stuff out here and bring in some free weights." Oh. you know, his trainer was sitting there in the interview and almost had a heart attack. So, which I wasn't going to get that job.
I tell you what.
I'm happy to get the interview. And
I guarantee Coach Paterno.
I still have the letter from him. Thanks, Jeff, for coming for the interview and all your information you gave us about powerlifting. I never said one word about powerlifting, so you know.
They don't realize. Yeah. Well, I was like Coach Bryant said, I went in there and I was all geared up, you know, ready for a big Q&A session, and he came in and we talked for a little over an hour.
Yeah.
And down around close to the hour, I said, Coach, I kind of looked at him. I said, "You don't want to know what we're doing with them?"
Yeah.
He said, "No." He said, "I already checked you out." And he said, you know what you're doing. And he said, "I've already figured that out by asking around about you."
Yeah.
And he said, "You know, I know what you can do."
Sure.
So, you know, he said then, he said, you know, I've never been around weight training. You know, it wasn't around when he played, you know, in college at Alabama.
Right. Yeah.
And it hadn't for all over many years. And so when, you know, the time came, you know, it was something that it was kind of new to him too.
Yeah. Well, you know, We very recently, actually, we talked to Steve Watterson, and we talked a little bit about, you know, the components that made for a very productive culture in at the NFL level. And I was just wondering, when you were with Dan Reeves, how did you view that culture in relationship to, you know, what made you so successful through your time with him? And, you know, just from a leadership standpoint within the team, the chemistry of the team, what were the things that you thought were extremely important in relationship to the productivity that you experienced?
Good question. Good question. Is first of all, Dan Reeves was a very, very competitive individual. And, you know, his 9 years playing running back for the Dallas Cowboys, and he played at a major university, South Carolina, and played for a good coach, and Coach Marvin Bass, and played there for, you know, of course, the one of the greats of all time, and Coach Landry. And he was a cut. He had, you know, Dan, Coach Landry gave him the off season to be able to run for a year. So, you know, he obviously did not know what to do with it all. So he went down and talked with Alvin Roy. Mm-hmm. And Alvin Roy, you know, showed him what to do, how to do it, and so forth. And so Dan went back and worked a year with it, and they saw great gains. That was when, you know, the old saying about the Cowboys, that they could get there, they just couldn't win the big one. Anyway, he understood it. So when they brought me in to interview me, he and I had a common denominator with Alvin Roy, because that's who I learned an immense amount from. And Dan Reeves is one of the finest people I've ever been around in my life. And one of the saddest days of my life when we lost him here not long ago. But he was a friend. He was certainly the man in charge. He was competitive. You just couldn't find a better. I don't know what adjectives I'm leaving out to be able to describe him, but he was something. He was a lot like Coach Bryant in some ways, and you know, but he made things a lot of fun. We had great staff to work for, work with, and we had great players. Dan, you know, knew a lot about it. He wanted to know a lot more about what we did than Coach Bryant did. And so I went in, had to explain to him and the rest of the coaches exactly how it was going to play out. You know, I think we had 16 weeks back then, Jeff. That's when you could really, you know, make some differentiation. Oh, yeah. And some, you could change kids. You really could. Okay. And or you could keep them at a high level for a lot of years. Right. You know, 28 years of age, you know, then that's the culprit. And you could be able to keep a lot of them going past that, which they make more money. You got a better ball player for a longer period of time, and so forth, so on.
Yeah.
But we had a great, great deal going there. Won a lot of football games, and we had a wonderful time. We really did. I followed him then from there. I was there 8 years with him. We had a lot of great players at that time. We had a drive. We went to New York, stayed with the Giants there for 4 years, and then went down and to Atlanta. And I forgot, I think we were together 7 years, and they made a change right there and brought in somebody else. And I spent 2 more years there, and that's when I left.
Now, do you remember any great team leaders within the team?
Oh, good gosh, yeah. I mean, man, we were full of them. Yeah, well, sure. I mean, you know, those are Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, John Elway was a great one. We, you know, Tom Jackson was a great one. Reuben Carter, Reuben Jones. We had Sammy Winder was a great, great leader, running back. Played, oh gosh, Sammy played 8 or 9 years and from Southern Miss. Golly, I'm going to leave out some. I know. Oh, we had Carl Mecklenburg. Boy, Carl was a 12th round draft choice, ended up making all pro somewhere about like 5 or 6 times. I don't know. A lot of great kids. Secondary wise, boy, we had a lot of them. We had Steve Atwater just went into the Hall of Fame. So, I mean, he was a phenom. We had another one out there that they were like bookends, Dennis Smith, and Dennis was the other safety. Brother, I tell you what, that was tough sledding if you ran into those two. I promise you, they'd knock sparks off of you. We had, you know, Michael Brooks was a linebacker. You know, and I know that I'm leaving out some people that shouldn't be, but we had some great, great, great players in those periods of time there. Yeah.
Yeah. And my point is that leadership matters. You know, it matters.
Yeah. We had the leaders that were there. They were leaders and players. And, you know, a lot of times players are leaders by what they do.
Yeah.
And they play and they'll just go up and, you know, bingo somebody or make a heck of a play or run 80 yards with the ball. And, you know, and everybody, it just turns everybody's motor on. Some people have to come up, you know, and verbally have to say some things to some people and get them going that way. But yeah, down through the years. Yeah. Phil Sims, great athletes and great leaders. Lawrence Taylor was a great leader. We got time for a quick story.
Absolutely.
We're opening the season. We're playing in Chicago. Chicago's pretty good, and we're pretty good. We don't know how good we are, but we're playing, and we go out on the ball pretty good. And we go up, I think, 24, and they start coming back. It gets down to fourth quarter, you know, and so they're starting to move, and so I get excited on the sideline, boy, and then they're starting, and then it's a third down. And I said, LT, I said, you stop them, you know. And, boy, I never will forget right there. He looked at me, and I said, oh, Lord have mercy, I made this guy mad. I said, he's going to kill me and eat me, you know. And I said, he went right back out there, and he sacked the quarterback and recovered the fumble, and he ran back to the sidelines, Jeff, and he came right in. I was standing right there, and I had a smile on my face. I didn't know what he was going to do. You know, he pitched me the ball, and he said something like that right there. I said, now that right there is pretty good, I tell you what. But he was, he was quite an athlete. He sure was. He really was. Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah, when I was at Carolina, Butch brought him in. Butch Davis brought him in to talk to the team. And and he was on the sideline the whole game. And I had a hard time keeping him back.
Oh, boy.
He wanted to go on the field.
I tell you what. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was for real. He was good. And we went to Atlanta and then and we had some great football. They had not done well. And the first year we went in there and I forgot, we started off real slow, then ended up finishing real good and went 8-8. And then next year we went 14-2 and went to the Super Bowl. And
right.
Then as things would have it that, you know, everybody wanted your players that time and players were, you know, without contract, and they made some money. Had a lot of them that changed and went, and took a few years to rebuild. And then we had some other good years, and had a great quarterback named Michael Vick. And boy, I tell you what, he was He was a rare breed. He was a lot like Steve Atwater, and some of those other kids. That I had a kid when I was in Northwestern. Many of you may remember this name. His name was Joe Delaney. And Joe came from a little town named Halton, which is over here close to Shreveport, Louisiana. And boy, Joe was something. Joe played, he was drafted by, he was running back. Well, we brought him in as a defensive back, didn't know where to put him. And so eventually we got him, you know, in the second year, we put him at tailback. And my goodness gracious, he was phenomenal. I left before his senior year, but he went on and became, was a second round draft choice. And then in 3 years, I think in the NFL, he made all pro 3 years in a row. And I tell you what, this tells you the old story though, right here, Jeff. It's right outside of town over here, close to the airport. There were three kids in it was just a pond of water that was built strictly to hold water so it could be able to be used to irrigate some area around there. Well, three kids, these little kids jumped in there and just started swimming, and none of them could swim. Mm. And Joe was over there close by, and so they're drowning. And Joe, I'll never forget this. Joe used to come in the weight room up there, you know, in the afternoon after he would take a class, and the class was swimming. And boy, I mean, he'd just fall down on the floor right there. And I mean, sweat would be just dripping off of him. And I said, "Tough one today, Joe." He said, "Coach," he said, I can't swim on that. You know, I just can't stay afloat. And I said, "Well, you all muscle one thing." I said, "You go right like a rock. You just drop to the bottom." Well, anyway, Joe went out and he saved two of the three kids. And he drowned along with the last one. Yeah. And we had there's a big monument built out here a number of years ago, I think 3 or 4 years ago, that they had a big deal. But he was one of the real premier players of my career. And that team, gosh, I don't know what that was, 1979, somewhere in there, Jeff. They had a relay team, and three of the four kids played pro ball on that relay team, and they won the NCAA that year.
Wow.
Four by one. Yeah, 400 meter relay. They could run. I mean, run. Yeah. So.
Well, couple more things. There's a little thing in football that you see every week called an upset. Mm-hmm. And so far this year, you got App State beat Texas A&M. You got Georgia Southern beat Nebraska, which might have cost that guy his job. Marshall beat Notre Dame. And so I've always been very interested in the human dimension of things. And, you know, this phenomenon that no matter what talent you have on a team, you might get knocked off. Mm-hmm. And if you are not prepared. And you know, some people, I've always really believed that emotion matters. And, some people that I've met in football, they say emotion only matters the first few plays and then it's all execution, but I don't really subscribe to that. I really think that this is one of the things that if you could find the formula for strengthening the human dimension and consistency of attitude and effort week in and week out that goes along with the talent, where you wouldn't be, subjected to an upset here and there, I think it would be a very important part of the training of a football team, you know. And I don't know how you find that, because
Yeah. I think you and I both come to the realization, understanding anyway, of, you know, making the kid, get him at his very best, get him in great shape, get him strong as we can, pliable and so forth, and all of the other attributes that have to go in there. But the mind, boy, that's an oyster that is hard to crack. And I don't know. It's not going to be in my time.
Yeah.
It may be in yours and you guys, you know, because they're doing a lot of things now, you know, with stuff that has really gained. But I don't know, Jeff. I don't know. They spend countless hours, dollars, and everything else of taking scouts and our coaches to go around to try to, you know, see if Jeff Connors is going to fit the mold for a linebacker for us, you know, and then this, that, and the other. But, you know, is there any – I don't know. You know, it's his old saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure. So I just don't know. I don't know. It's not – I don't think it's anywhere – somebody may have a handle on it. I'm down here just worried about the fish are biting today, you know, and I don't know. Don't know anymore. I've just kind of gone on. But all the other stuff, I think that they're getting better at all the time. They're making headway. But I think a lot of it is going over plowed ground already. And so I think that the same things that work still work. And I think that I truly believe this, that the differentiation in a lot of the strength coaching has to do with the technique that they can teach and are they believable, you know, when they say something.
Yeah.
And then in the you know, aura that they can set forth in the room and things that they can demand from the kids, and they will, you know, try to achieve it. So I think those things right there, they're always going to be very important. Very important. There's no doubt.
I got to go to a Marine Corps Military Leadership seminar at the Pentagon. I guess they chose some people, somebody nominated me to go, but, and I've always been reading these books on military leadership. And I wrote a book called Collegiate Battlefield, where, you know, I basically took leadership principles from the military to apply to athletics. But, it's very interesting to me that a lot of military people, and even in the manuals, it'll talk about, the difference to winning these battles is the human dimension. And, you know, that's why I always wanted to do tough things with my guys. I wanted them to overcome tough things. So they had that component, they had that characteristic of toughness. Yep. And they, you know, they had the belief that there's no way these guys across the field worked harder than we did. There's no way they're in better shape than us.
Right.
And, you know, that's a little bit tougher to do these days. I did some things back then that, might've been questionable, but, at the same time, you know, I still believe that it had great value.
Sure. No doubt. I guarantee it did. You know, I think that's, you know, if you take a guy like Audie Murphy, one of the highest decorated soldiers in World War II, and you look at him, you know, he looked like sophomore in high school, you know. So I don't, you know, why? And then you go ask yourself that question, and I don't know. I just don't know.
Right.
I got no idea, Jeff. I can't help you, brother.
Well, I'm going to just say a few things about training to kind of wrap it up as our last topic here. When I came to visit you, you introduced me to the importance of the single leg squat. Mm-hmm. The ball on the wall squat, mm-hmm. the the overhead squat, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the complexes, many of which I guess had originated with euphoric.
Then
when I got into kettlebells with Steve, I just came up with a lot of my own complexes with kettlebells as well.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite complexes was top down, get down, where you get a double kettlebell press to a double kettlebell swing to a long cycle swing to a clean and then a squat. Mm-hmm. And you did five of those and, you know, different types of complexes with kettlebells and barbells. I really liked over the years. And I really liked those with the young guys. And, you know, you can talk about testing and evaluation, which is important, but I like to be on the floor watching these guys all the time. That was my thing.
There you go. Tell
right there who's got issues.
There you go.
I didn't need to do the functional screening.
There you go.
I didn't have time for corrective strategies that may not even be effective.
Right.
You know, once the NCAA got involved, hey, I got 6 weeks to get these guys ready.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if I can afford to tell you this is, hey, guys, this is a deload week. If I thought the guys needed to go lighter, then I would put that into training. I would basically print it out for them, and mm-hmm. I would change the percentage values for them across the board if I felt like we needed some restoration.
Mm-hmm.
But during my last few years, I had a hard time agreeing with some of these young people coming in the door mm-hmm. and wanting me to waste the hour and a half, 2 hours I had, 8 hours a week I had on all these muscle activation strategies, mm-hmm. corrective strategies. I wanted to take them out, do a dynamic warm-up, which was movement,
mm-hmm.
which was postural type of drilling, because posture was so important. I did my absolute speed work first. I did my acceleration work first. I went into the weight room, and when we got to the weight room, guess what? We didn't need a whole lot of muscle mm-hmm. activation. We just mm-hmm. went through muscle activation.
That's right.
And even on days that were tempo days when we would condition first and go lift, I had guys hit PRs all the time after 45 minutes of running. So that was my experience, you know, I didn't know if it was right, but you know, I wanted to run first. I wanted my guys to be fresh to do their sprint work. And then if it was, let's say it's a 4-day split and you're doing your Olympic lifts, maybe you want them fresh to do the Olympic lifts first. And so you might make that a tempo day and do your tempo running yeah. after you lift.
Right. Right.
Or you might prefer a 3-day program, particularly with your skill guys, because you might want to do more speed work and more type of plyometric and explosive type activity. You know, you wanted those 2 days in between to do more movement type stuff, maybe more conditioning type things for those guys. And then the other day we were talking and I mentioned the fact that Boo Shakesnyder would always talk about, because Boo's one of my mentors also. Mm-hmm. Boo would say, hey, you know, when you get into the getting in toward track season, and of course we're talking about sprinters and hurdlers,
right,
you want to come off of the heavy squats and go to ballistics so that you recapture coordination, elasticity, and proprioception, which made a lot of sense to me.
Right.
At the same time, you're definitely going to, where the Olympic lifts are concerned now, I always believe that at some point, whether it's 10 days or you know, whatever the number of days that you have in season, you got to hit that heavy lift again.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically you've got to have intensity, either heavy, something heavy or fast to stimulate that nervous system and to keep those explosive attributes over a period of time. And those are kind of the things in the way of thinking that I kind of thought Al Miller's thinking this way. You know, he wants foundational strength. You talked about foundational strength. You talked about it's tough to become more powerful unless you have foundational strength. And then you can go back to Alvin Mills Pyramid and see the things there as well. You know, I came up with my own power quotient. I took five values of vertical jump. I'd add that up. I took three values of broad jump in inches, and I'd get that number. I took one value of a max power clean. I added those three numbers and divided by 40 times. And that worked extremely well for me.
I'm not smart enough to do that, Jeff.
Well, I'm just saying, I don't know. I have a combination of horizontal vertical components, horizontal vertical power.
Yeah, makes
and then when sense. I divided, when I divided that number of those three things by 40 time, and if you had better numbers, and if you had a better 40 time, guess what? You had a higher score. Yeah. And I said, hey, this is it for me, because I had Bruce Carter that played in the league for a while. He had a 405 power clean. He had a 11-foot broad jump, a 40-inch vert, and he ran a 4.340, and that was my highest guy. You know, he had like a 227 or something like that score.
Yeah.
And so what people say about the value of rate coding as an adaptation, and the fact that rate coding is pliable. It comes and goes. If you're not doing something explosive, you're going to lose that adaptation.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you are. I'll tell you this right now. The biggest thing, you know, and I'm an old man, and I'm on my way out the door. And y'all be talking about me rather than with me here in a number of years. But the one thing that I see that still is not being done today, by the young strength coaches, and a lot of them by the older strength coaches, and you just said it right there, is that, you know, people, Istvan Javorek is a very, very intelligent, smart man. And when he created these exercises, he put them together, it was to teach the Olympic lifts. But it's in the same body movement, same bar movement as the exercises themselves, but you're doing it at a weight that is a percentile of your own body weight. So you're not handling heavy weights that put an unjust and unrelenting amount of weight on a kid that's going to possibly end up in an injury. And you're doing something that you can do just exactly what you just got through saying, is watch and see what he can't do. If I can take Jeff Connors and figure out what Jeff Connors cannot do in a workout, and then tell Jeff when it's over with, Jeff, this is what you can't do, this is what we're going to do in place of it. Boy, bingo, you become a guru, you know?
Yeah.
And then I help the kid. First of all, you're not going to get hurt, Jeff. Then you're going to get better. And it's going to be a process, but the process is going to produce at the end results a stronger, faster, more durable athlete. So learning to do those exercises, what a great conditioner it is, what a great teacher it is. You can sit and watch one kid do six exercises and never have to move. And you can, if you're a good coach, which most coaches should, the eye of the coach is always, as we know. I mean, you've got to be able to be a great teacher. You got to be a teacher. And teachers, you just can't watch one kid. You got to watch all 30 in the room at one time. You got to watch all X amount of them in the weight room. Yeah. Watch them, what they do. And you have got to be a technical fool on those exercises. You got to be a teacher extraordinaire on the technique of the movement. And when you do that and get them, just like you said, to demand them to do the things full speed and explosive, then everything's going to fall in place. You're not going to have near the injuries. And you're going to have a more complete, at the end of the training period, you can retest again, and I guarantee you, you're going to make improvement. I mean, it's not like shooting frogs on a basket, you know?
Sure. Well, yeah. Coach, if you can believe it, I even like a double kettlebell snatch hold. You know,
I don't know if I can remember doing all that. Yeah.
I must be crazy.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Well, Coach, I really appreciate the time, and I get into these conversations. It's like sitting around a campfire for me.
I know. I know. Yeah, I know.
You know, the other thing that I would say just about training is that I think it's really important to break up the week properly, particularly with your skill guys. And I think acceleration, absolute speed, tempo work, over speed work.
Yeah.
Maybe you might have a sprint float sprint day. I think all these things have value in relationship to development, and it's important to know how to break it up to where you have, you know, proper recovery and restoration. But I really think that all those things are necessary if you hope to. And in my experience, I felt like it took me 2 years of hard work to actually get people faster, and they had to buy into it.
That I tell you what, getting stronger, it's, you know, you can do.
Yeah.
Getting more explosive now when you start adding the speed of the bar in there. That's a little differentiation. And then when you get starting talking about speed being there, then now you're in a different deal altogether. Right. You're in a different mode. One thing that I've seen, you know, is everybody, when they go out to create speed, we're going to run what? We're going to run a 40.
Yeah.
How far is first base? 90 feet, right?
Right.
Basketball floor is what, 92, 3 feet? So, I mean, that's as far as you can run. In football, the biggest portion of the game is 20 yards. And very, very, very few times will anybody ever get an opportunity to really just take off and run, you know, straight. And if they are usually the outside people that get that opportunity. So the explosion part of it, the biggest part of the game, you know, of any game, of basketball, of football, of baseball, it's, you know, it is acceleration. It's an acceleration that you don't ever – 33 yards takes Olympian to be able to reach maximum speed. You don't have that in sports. And so consequently, the biggest part of that is the acceleration. That's the deal that you really, really got to spend a lot of time on. Now, does not mean that you neglect the top end speed, but, you know, first things first.
Yeah.
So that's something. And understand the correct way to be able to run. And look at what the person should look like when they are running, just running down the field at 70 to 75% of their speed rate. If they are running and are using the right mechanics, foot placements, body position, and coach that. No, don't coach that the same way that you would in there, a power clean, a snatch, or a squat. Same way, same thing. And do it and understand it and be able to tell them. And the same way with jumps, you know, be able to do the same way with jumps. Where do you land? How do you land? You know, and so forth and so on. So be a complete coach of everything you ask the kids to do.
Yeah.
Make sure that they know what to do. Don't go so fast that you overdo it. And if a kid can't do it, keep him there.
Yeah.
He's telling you. He's just no more than raising his hand and said, hey, Coach Connor, I can't do this thing. Now, they're not going to just jump up and say that. They got too much pride. But they can't do it. So if they can't do it, then that's up to you, the coach, to be able to say, now, we're going to keep you here until you can develop this quality to be able to do bingo, whatever it be. Whether it be lifting, jumping, running, it doesn't make any difference. Or maybe stretching.
Right. Know? I'll say one more thing about the history of speed training. I brought my friend I became friends with through a man named Ronnie Jones, who you might be might know Ronnie, but Ronnie basically introduced me to wild man, crazy man, Kevin McNair, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
And I brought Kevin into East Carolina, and I used him as a mentor over the phone when I was at Carolina, and I talked to him over the years. And then I did not even know that Kevin passed away.
Yeah, I didn't know a lot of them did. Yeah.
But he, he was there in the beginning of things, talking about body position, talking about mm-hmm. force application, talking mm-hmm. about arm stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that I think that he talked about, some track coaches may disagree with at this point, but what Kevin was trying to do is get people to accelerate and use their whole body to accelerate. And, and of course he had that speed terminology that he used, where you'd correct the body part basically on the run, focus meant to, mm-hmm. get your head level,
mm-hmm.
And so that body position terminology from head to toe. So that's kind of where I started to become extremely interested in speed development. And I played DB in college, so I was interested in it anyway. But then Lauren Seagrave.
There you go. I'm fixing it. Yeah.
On through.
Yeah.
I'd travel anywhere in the country to hear somebody speak or bring them in if we had the money to bring them in. And I had a lot of passion for learning speed. And I think that's something that right now has become very, very popular out there. It's grown immensely as far as the speed development end of things. But for a long period of time, there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis on it.
Not much understood about it, Jeff. Right. And I tell you right now, I tell you one of the things that Johnny Parker, Al Vermeil, and myself did is that we found out in the mid 80s there, if I go to a clinic and sit and listen to Jeff Connors speak for an hour, I get what you know in an hour.
Yeah.
If I really got something that bings the little bell up here, I'm going to go get Jeff Connors, fly him into wherever I am at that time, keep him there for 2 or 3 days, say, Jeff, we're going to pay you this amount of money, put you up and do all these things. I've got you, and then I video you, and I can pick you like a chicken. For 3 days or two days. We did that with Al took some, Johnny took some, and I took some. And we would go to the best in the world and we'd fly them in. And we were in the NFL and our NBA at that time. And so we had the capability of doing that.
Right.
And that furthered, to tell you, I'm sitting here and I do all this. I'm the originator of little and thief of a lot. I can be honest with you. And, I'm telling you, and a lot of people nowadays in time get all bowled up because they Miller told me that I was squatting and my heels came up. It's like, we don't all have all the answers, and I guarantee you I don't. But the thing is that I was a mad hunt for them all the time. And those three guys right there, we had one time, I promise you, when I retired there at Atlanta, I had a long shelf box there's no telling how many videos I had in there of everybody that you can imagine. And when I left, I had my lip all poked out because, I knew it was over. I just left them. And I wish I'd have kept them and I could have given them. I wasn't that smart to be able to give them to some young, high school coaches and more stuff. And I find myself, that's hindsight. And but if a guy wants to be able to try to go to one person right now, day and time, and I know there are some really good ones. I'm just talking about my time. I think Al Vermeil understood so much about of every facet of it.
Right.
He's coached it. Coached it at a high level, coached it at a low level. He's coached it all the way through. And I think he understands all aspects of training and applying that training to whatever sport that you are trying to be able to get better at. And he's golden. Now, there's a researcher out there by the name, Lord have mercy, Mike Stone. And Mike Stone's and is one of the best too. And like you said, Lauren Seagrave is one of the best. You know, we hired Lauren, worked for us at Atlanta for 4 years, maybe even 5 years.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so I learned a lot from him. His wife taught my daughter how to hurdle, and she was about the fourth in the world at that time. So,
yeah,
it's, you know, ask these people, you know, and they will help you. If they are coaches, they're going to do just like Jeff Connors and Al Miller are doing.
Yeah.
I don't have to do this. You don't have to do this, but we're trying to do it to be able to bring the word to these guys out there that are trying to make a living doing this and get better, to find some way that, yeah, they're going to put one more point up there than the other team's got. And that's it. And then they're going to, in turn, help the kid. They're going to teach him all of the things, a lot of the things that are not taught anymore in the house, the schools, and all the other places, and that's work, discipline, and so forth and so on.
Right. There's a ton of intelligent people out there, and there's a ton of knowledge out there. And, of course, with the internet, I mean, you can
– oh, man.
You can find all kinds of gurus out there quick.
Yeah, you got to be careful of them. There are a lot of them out there self-anointed.
Yeah. And I know the thing that was always interesting to me about the profession also is, you know, you can be a good strength coach and be losing games, and you can be a bad strength coach and be winning games. And that's going to justify or maybe not justify what you do. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's right. But
those good players will make you look a whole lot smarter. I can promise you. Yeah. And I've been fortunate to be on that end of it a lot of times. I promise you that. You bet.
Well, I'm thankful to God that, you know, I was able to have a good career, stay in a career for a period of time that took me to retirement. And, you know, I got nothing but thanks. And I feel like I've been extremely blessed. And that's what I'm trying to do now is maybe bring some blessings to someone else. And,
give back to what somebody gave to you. Yeah. I've tried my dead level best and, to do the very same thing, Jeff. Yeah.
Well, can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Always great to talk to you. And I really.
It's fun to get back together again after all these years and see each other again. We, you know, but yeah, I appreciate you thinking of me, first of all, and including me, second of all. And it's been a lot of fun. Love to kick it around. And any other time I can be of any help to anybody, then please let me know.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm going to sign off now. This is Coach Jeff Connors signing off for Absolute Empowerment and armoredlife.org. God bless you. Please join us next week. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on the Sports Objective. Join us every Monday night for a new edition of the show. Listen to the show pretty much everywhere podcasts are found. Be sure to follow us on social media at The Sports OBJ on Twitter and TikTok, at The Sports Objective on Instagram. Like and follow our Facebook page and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show, and go Pirates!